everybody likes to say they play them a lot. So welcome to our next episode here of the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Armchair Dragoons. Mirth is back because we can't pay him to go away. Howdy, Chris. How you doing?
Glad to be back. I'm more sober than my last two appearances.
Well, that's not hard. And as a first-time guest on Mentioned in Dispatches, we have our good buddy Anthony Galela. Howdy, Anthony. How are you?
Hey, I am fantastic. Good to be talking with you all again.
I think there may be very few people we've ever had on one of our podcasts that is more tied into the gaming industry than you. I'm not sure if that says more about who we've got on the podcast or that you really are one of those luminaries, but...
I don't know about that.
Yeah. So the...
I like to think a lot. I don't know if I'm very illuminated. That's one of those things.
Well, Chris is
talking about how he collects games. I got to tell you, at my height, I'm pretty short, but at my height of collecting is what I mean. I had about 4,000 games. And, yeah, I was... You know, I was so tired of, like, moving those beautiful things around that I moved to Seattle from Columbus, and I sold thousands of games at Origins and a little bit over the internet.
Probably owned some of them, actually.
Yeah, probably.
I think you were about half of the auction one year, weren't you?
I was. I really was.
So... So, Chris, I know you're not up into the 4,000 range. Are you in the 400 range?
I don't know. I'm sitting here. I can actually look in the room that I'm in right now. It's 30 games. And that's my dining room.
That's just what you can see.
Yeah, no, that's just what I know. I've got boxes. You know, I'm not the Bonsai Cat level.
Yeah.
Look at this,
yeah.
500 list. I got nothing on that. I do have a game coming. I do have the Dark Valley coming. Bought that.
Anthony, a question for you. In that 4,000 that you're talking about, how much of that was like self-contained games, and how much of it was sort of expansions, modules, variants, rule books for stuff?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. That's independent games. That's not counting all the modules and so forth for them.
Yeah, because I've Yeah, I've got a hefty collection of tabletop games. I'm in the low hundreds, right? I'm not in four digits yet. But if you start throwing in like all of the RPG products, I probably crack 1,000 pretty easily. And that's not counting like all the magazines separately, right? Yeah, I'm not counting all the Dragon magazines separately. And of note, especially for RPG products, which are much easier to use as soft copies than hard copies. That doesn't count the giant PDF collections that I've got piling up on different hard drives around here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's the thing, like for Wargamers, who are the core of our audience, you need the physical copies, right? You need the hexes and counters to push around the map. We all kind of get that. But for the role players in the crowd, of which you've been one for much of your life, and so have I, you can get away with soft copies of a lot of role playing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just picked up Psychosis 2, still an old game, 90s maybe, from like the dawning of the Digest games, and I had a copy of Psychosis 1, which is a standalone great game. Everybody wakes up. They don't know what's going on. They're crazy. Maybe they're not crazy. Who knows? And then you role play through that. And then it was great. And I finally played it. And then I was like, I got to get Psychosis 2. And just like you're saying, PDF. I'm like, great. No problem.
Yeah.
I don't need the physical copy.
Chris is hearing your description of the game and he's thinking that's Monday.
Yeah. I just think that's this fascinating game. I call that life. I mean,
yes. That's right. You know, I travel a lot for work, and it's like that because you wake up in the beginning of the game, the characters all wake up and they're like, "Where am I?" And I do that in every hotel room. I wake up, open my eyes, and I'm like, all right, where am I? This is not my room. So
I'm not home.
You have to pass the reality check, right?
Right. That's right. And sometimes I fumble. It takes me a minute.
Yeah. No, we all do. Don't worry about that.
Oh, man.
So
I get you excited. Like, after all of these games, you were saying you had one game coming, and you could hear the excitement in your voice about it. Like, what is it? After you've played and seen so many damn games, you're still like, ooh.
I know, right? Well, it's such a social... I have a buddy that I game with all the time, and he has the damn game coming. So then I had to get the game, just because we're going to play it. I don't need the game, because he has it. We're going to play it, but I want to have the rules, and I want, you know... And it's you asked the question, it's a social thing. Like, he's going to get the game, so I need to have the game. And the problem is, we're only going to use one copy of the damn game. But this happens all the time, I mean.
Yeah. You
know? And it's also, like, I know it's a great game, and I definitely want to have it and add to, I mean, I'm a collector, that's the bottom line. Like, but, you know, it's just the idea that, like, we're each going to have a copy of the game, we're each going to have our rules, and then we're going to be able to play it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, no, I'm a total, I get into that whole, I'm a hook, I get hooked, that's how it happens. You
know? Chris, let me ask, so, it's Ted Racer, how many other Ted Racer games do you have?
I don't know, a lot. I would have to do an inventory. I own seven. And the whole thing is, the Dark Valley is like his masterpiece. And
yeah.
The guy's great. He's a great designer. So I'm absolutely going to own the game.
So here's the second question, though. It's World War II East Front. It's not like there's a dearth of games on the East Front of World War II. How many?
Trust me, I know that too.
That was my follow-up question. How many World War II East Front games do you have?
All of them. I mean, going back to, like, the Russia campaign, it would be easier almost if I had served on the fucking Russian East Front. It would be a less traumatic experience than the games that I've played again and again and again and again.
And so, you know,
do I need this game? No, I'm absolutely going to own it. This is the whole thing, like, GMT Compass, they know what I want, you know, and so, like, GMT's, they're doing their Bulge game, Sound of Trumpets or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, I was going to say, that doesn't narrow it down. You make it sound like they only have one Bulge game.
I probably own at least a dozen Bulge games, very specific to the Bulge, and I'm absolutely going to get, you know... So they're doing, Time of Trumpets. They're doing that. Oh, I'm going to get that, you know. I need a Bulge game. Like, I need a hole in the head.
Yeah, Anthony, you asked sort of what is it that continually gets you excited about those. I think for a lot of the Wargamers specifically, there are some designers that we all happen to really like. And so when a designer that you like tackles a new topic to him, or her, there's a couple of hers out there. You want to go see how that person did it differently than someone else. And, you know, there's probably two dozen games for, you know, with Rommel and the Battle of Gazala. There's two of them from separate publishers with the title Rommel at Gazala. So, I mean, But you're interested to see how does Pete Bogdazarian tackle it separately from Jim Werbeneth, separately from some, and how do they each sort of put their own spin on what they think is important, what they think matters, what they want to model in their games. Some guys are modeling logistics better. Some guys are modeling command and control better. Some guys are modeling the maneuver piece better. Some guys care about morale. Some guys don't care about morale, and it's all about the technical details and the mechanics of the game, of the equipment. So,
yeah.
You know, there are a variety, and there's no one right answer. You know, I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can approach modeling those games. But I think that's one of the things that gets a lot of the war gamers coming back to the same topics over and over, is to see how somebody else modeled something that was essentially the same topic. And especially for historical topics, like, we know what happened in the Bulge. You know, I mean, there's not a lot of mystery of what went on in the Bulge. But how much did morale matter? How much did ammo matter? How much did maneuver matter? How much did the weather matter? You know, there's some games that model the weather in much greater detail than others. And so I think for a lot of the wargamers who dig into that, you know, a lot of the historical nuances, they want to see how all these different pieces work together and interchange.
That's one thing I really liked about the magazines. I used to play the magazine about, you know, every month from a few different publishers. You know, exactly what you're saying. It's like, oh, all right, this little thing, this little bit here. But what's going to be important here? What are you going to look at? And you're also making me think about when I played Through the Ages for the first time. And, of course, I played Age of Renaissance a ton back in the day. Just a little difference between them, where in Age of Renaissance, like, religion is creates misery in your cultures, right? And through the ages, religion creates happiness, right? And you're just like, okay, that's interesting. The, you know, difference between the philosophies of these two designers. What's going on here? So I totally get what you're saying. Absolutely.
Yeah, I would definitely want to have a discussion with people that think religion creates happiness. we're gonna have a chat.
Right.
I noticed that a lot throughout a lot of the role playing collection that I have as well, because there's only so many different ways you can stat out. I hit him in the head with a stick, right? I mean, there's only so many different ways you can crunch those numbers, but. I've been amazed throughout the years of how many different role-playing games you see pop out there that are sort of kind of one gimmick built around them. You know, there was there's probably three people ever that will ever hear this podcast that know what I'm talking about. There was a game called Swordbearer in the late 70s, early 80s from, I want to say it was from Heritage Games, small little cardboard box. Interestingly, that one of their production twists was, instead of opening like a regular book where the spine is on the long side, the spine was on the short side, so the books opened wide, even though the box was the same size as like the old D&D white boxes. Swordbearer was typical, normal, hack and slash, fantasy, medieval background kind of thing. The one gimmick that they had in there was that there was no monetary system. What you had access to was based on your social status. So social status became an important feature in the game, but as a result, you didn't have to, like, track, you know, the hordes of gold pieces you were schlepping around. And once you were up higher in social status, you could afford a horse. So you didn't have to actually go buy the horse. You just sort of added the horse to your character sheet. Now you could ride around instead of walking. It was one gimmick. Like, everything else about the game was just standard fantasy role-playing tropes of the early 80s. But they published a game around this one shtick. And I'm sure you could probably think of a half a dozen others off the top of your head that were very similar in that. Give me one shtick, let's build a game around it, call it good. You know, there were plenty like that.
I had never heard of it. Now I have to play it. The cover art's by Bill Willingham, by the way. That's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, I've got the box copy here somewhere. There was a second edition that they published with a slightly better box. That a friend of mine had told me about. I've got one of the original first edition boxes here somewhere or another. You know, the dual role playing game was, their shtick was the magic system. You cannot possibly think of a spell that we can't account for in the magic system somehow. And it's because the magic system was a very mechanical thing. It was all stat based. Every possible spell had the effect of, it either raised or lowered one of your stats, or it raised or lowered an opponent's stat. It raised or lowered your health, or raised or lowered an opponent's health, or it moved you from place to place. Those were the five different effects that you could have. And so a fireball lowers an opponent's health. So does a lightning bolt. It lowers an opponent's health. And how you built it, it was a very mechanical sort of stat-building approach to the magic system. How you described it was totally up to you. You know, but that's
so. Then the focus was more on maybe more on telling the story than that, getting into the mechanics. I would guess
that was the idea. The idea was by putting a very simple set of mechanics in place, you knew the game effect at a very almost primal level, and the story you wove over top of the game effect was what they wanted you to pay more attention to.
Yeah.
And so that's what they were focused on. And, you know, not a bad approach to take. But again, it was everything else in the game, you know, actually creating your stats, the adventuring and journeying and looting stuff and, you know, whatever else. It, again, all standard fantasy tropes in this case of the late 80s. But it was, you know, the rest of the game, there's nothing all that remarkable about it. The magic system was the one unique kind of cool thing that they put in place. But what you run into with a lot of role-playing games, and this is something completely separate than you would ever be able to pull off in a war game, if you like the idea of social status as a proxy for money in a role-playing game, you can graft that system onto a different game pretty easily.
Yeah.
But, you know, if Chris really happens to like the logistics system from OCS, he can't just slap it on Dark Valley and call it good. Anthony, you got to go raid PAX, and I think when I saw online, you it was 22, 24 new games that you tried in one weekend?
Yes. I don't remember the exact account, but yeah, it was definitely that. That was our focus. I went with a couple of friends, Phil and Jen. And we had a little powwow ahead of time, a little planning session like you do. You know, what's our focus? What do we want to do? And we just cut away to the core. And that was the core. We wanted to play, we wanted to learn new games. You know, I'm out there doing public speaking and doing stuff for the Air Force and not playing a lot of games. I don't know about you guys. And so I was like, I gotta play new games. Yeah, so that's what we focused on. We picked a few that we knew that we'd read about, Board Game Geek and other places, and we're like, all right, we got to hit these. Like Photosynthesis, we had to play Photosynthesis and see what that was all about. But aside from that, you know, we just went around and saw what got us excited, and we played and played and played and played and played. It was fantastic. I recommend it.
Any highlights?
Well, I like Photosynthesis. That was pretty good. Nice little mechanic with the sun going around, and it was one of those games. It's abstract, with the, you know, the theme makes sense with the abstractness, which is cool. But in the end, it's an abstract game, and like many of those games, it's good ones anyway. Initially, you might be like, "All right, well, this is pretty simple," but each step further you think about how the sun's going to hit your trees and how that's going to cast a shadow on the other trees and what's going to happen three turns from now and what possibly could mess with that and how you want to set yourself up for success and if you want to score quick points or long points or some combination thereof, all that stuff. And then you run out of trees. If you don't do it correctly, you short yourself trees and so forth. And suddenly you're like, oh shit, I'm thinking about 10 things. I'm not thinking about two or three things now. I'm thinking about 10 things. And then it becomes, you know, even more interesting. But those three things get you started on the game and you can play and have fun and enjoy it and then, you know, pick it up. And so you don't have to master the 10 things initially. So anyway, that was pretty cool. I liked, Cat Lady quite a bit. Quick throwaway game, but you know, those are harder to design in my opinion, because they can be thrown away.
Yeah.
you play it once and you're done. And I feel that way about Cat Lady. I felt like, we could play it and play it and play it. And you're collecting cats and toys and food and you're playing with your cats and feeding your cats, but you're also trying to collect more cats at the same time. But you have to keep them happy while you're collecting more and more cats, so you have to be careful about your balance, your collecting balances and so forth. So it's basically a set collecting game.
I'm having a flashback to the 90s and the Tamagotchi craze.
Right. Yes, eat those Tamagotchis, or you'll be sad. So, so yeah, those are a couple of games. I liked a lot of the stuff that we played, but I think those are two of the top ones. I did play one game I want to name out there, but I want to just mention, I was so sad. It was talked about so much. Everybody liked it so much. Theme was cool, and I'm just like, this is, I'm going to love this. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to have no choice. And I sat down and played it, and I basically solved it in a few turns. And it's cooperative, sitting around with a couple of other folks playing a game. And I'm like, look, this is how you win the game every time. Let's just do this. And I was just so sad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if you run into that with any games. But
well, one of the things that I've always tried to focus on when I'm playing stuff is that I may be sitting down and playing something that isn't necessarily for me, but then what I start thinking about is, okay, who do I know that would enjoy this? Because, you know, it's different strokes for different folks, right? I mean, there's some things people are really going to dig. There's other folks people are perfectly happy to walk away from. And so maybe it's just from, you know, being a content manager on multiple websites over the years where we're covering games for folks, but I always come back to, okay, this isn't my cup of tea, but who would enjoy this? You know, is this something Chris would dig? Is this something Doug would dig? Is this something Anthony would get a kick out of? And that's what I come back to, you know, a lot. So,
yeah, very good point.
Yeah.
Very
good. Chris, you've got Huzzah coming up here in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, about a month out. I mean, but yeah, it's mid-May, but we have a game day coming up where a lot of people are going to be playtesting stuff specifically for the con. I've signed up for some games knowing that they're going to be playtests, and then there'll be the con, you know.
Have they revised your Panzers marching to their death scenario to where you, you're ready to take another whack at it?
Well, we playtested that a couple of times, and, you know, the guy running it knew that he needed to make adjustments. So I haven't signed up for that one specifically for the con because I've already played it twice. So, but yeah, that one got there's a series of those games actually. It's not just him. There's a couple other guys running. It's all Aerocourt stuff from World War II. There's a few different games going on around that specific scenario. It'll be interesting to see how they play out. And it's not just, it's different rule sets kind of representing the same theme. So that's not the theme of the con, but there's kind of this mini theme going on within it where, you know, you have three or four different GMs running the same battle and different rule sets and all that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask, is whether or not they were all using the same rule set or different rules. So.
No, they're not. It's different rule sets, different scale. And they're all going to, just on the basis of that alone, they're going to play out differently.
Now, Huzzah's a little more minis heavy, correct?
It's fairly minis heavy. There are, you know, they've expanded it. It was always sort of, the organization behind it was always minis, historical minis based. And it's expanded a lot over the years, but it's definitely a minis-heavy convention overall.
So, lots of cool terrain setups as well.
Yeah, there's some really impressive tables that people put on. There's going to be a bolt action actually has taken off in the past couple of years, and there's an entire room, basically an entire hall that's just bolt action games. And the guys that are doing that, the terrain they're putting together is just gorgeous. Absolutely, it's as good as anything you could see.
Where is it held?
It's Portland, Maine. It's coming up next month. It's been going on for over 10 years, actually. It's a fairly good New England con. We draw people from all over.
Nice. did you guys ever play? I'm trying to find a game, so maybe you can help me out. It used to be at Historicon like every year. And it was, you had Indians and trappers, and the trappers are going down a stream and trying to get through, doing whatever they're doing, and the Indians are trying to stop them. And then it was a thing, beautiful setup, nice miniatures, etc. I got the miniatures. I didn't get the rule set, and now I'm like, what was that rule set? I'm just thinking of it now again.
If we had our boy Cyrano on the line, he'd be able to tell you for sure.
Oh, man. All right. Well, we got to ask Cyrano.
Yeah.
I know there's, I mean, I've played stuff like that. I cannot tell you those, I mean, at this point, but yeah. And honestly, there'll be games like that going on at the convention that, you know, next year.
Yeah. Do you remember getting into miniatures? Like, what, do you know what it was where you're just like, oh, that's it right there?
Oh, I do. I mean, I know it quite clearly because, it was when I live in Portland now, which is southern Maine. But I remember when I first came down here, at the time I didn't do any minis gaming. I'd done, some BattleTech and I had played a couple of little like Civil War things, but I was never really into it. And then, at the time that I started coming down here, I got steered towards a group that was doing 28 mil World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hooked. I mean, the game was great. The figs were fantastic. The first time I played, actually, I was thrown into like this whole Stalingrad tractor factory battle where I was completely out of my element, but I just loved it, you know.
Yeah.
And even though I got hosed, I was hooked. I was like, I knew I was getting hosed. Like, I can, you know, every time I played, I was like, I can do better. And I would sit there and I would write out after action reports, like, and identify how I had screwed up and what I could do, and that's what got me into it. And I met a group of guys that were dedicated to that, and I did that for years, just 28 mil World War II skirmish, and I learned how to play it. I mean, and I became very good at it, but that led me to other stuff on top of it, like Napoleonic Civil War, you know, like, Yeah, so that was it. That was the gateway. And I mean, when I was younger, I started out playing, like BattleTech stuff, but I also played Axis and Allies. And then the first real hardcore board game I ever had was Advanced Third Reich.
Nice. That's going hardcore.
Nice.
I remember playing World of Flames, like, there was a group of guys, we did that, and what happened is, like, as I got into these games, I would start, like, reading a ton more history, which is kind of, you read the history, you want to play the game, then you play the game, you want to read more history, so it all fed into itself, and, now I have stacks of games in my kitchen.
So. You reminded me of how I play DBA. I'm always, like, you know, a third halfway through the game going, yep, I'm losing. Definitely, I see that. I see how I'm losing. I can't do anything about it. I won't do that next time. Nope, next time I'm losing again. All right, I got it.
Found a new mistake to make.
Yeah, it's always a new mistake. Always.
Eventually, though, you win some. I mean, I must have won a lot.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I was wondering, because I'm looking at a copy here of Cthulhu Wars. Oh my God, beautiful, as you know, and I've got a couple of factions, etc., and I have a nephew who comes over to the house sometimes, and, you know, I don't have a lot of toys from his perspective. From my perspective, I certainly do. So I'm like, what do I have to play with? And I'm like, those figures are so awesome, so I pop it out, and I'm like, go for it, you know, just play monster. And he's come over like three times. And now he's like, can you let me play with the monsters? And I'm like, all right, here we go.
There you go.
And he's pulling them out of the box, and there's a board, obviously. He pulls the board out, and this is the first time he pulls out the board, and he realizes that it's a board, not just something to play. And he's like, is this a game?
There you go.
Yes. Yeah, I felt like Mr. Burns. I was like, yes, it is. Yes.
Excellent.
You know, there was, I don't remember if you were still running Gamma at the time or not, but there was one year at Origins where the little swag bag giveaway bags included the Axis and Allies mini starter kits.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so it was...
I do remember that.
Yeah, two tanks and a half a dozen figures and a pair of fold-out maps and a bunch of dice. And everything. It was like everything you needed to have one small skirmish. And these were free in the swag bag, so everybody got one of these packs. And, of course, if you could find the crowd of role players all picking up their things all at the same time. They didn't want the A&A minis. They were more than happy to give them to you. So I ended up with like 14 of these sets. I had a couple of tank companies by the end of the convention. But that same year I had picked up, Mage Knight was going out of vogue. And so all the vendors were dumping their Mage Knight booster boxes for dirt cheap. You could get a booster box with five minis for like $1 or $2 at the most. And so I had a ton of these A&A minis. I had a ton of Mage Knight boosters that I'd picked up. Some of them had the little treasure chests in them, everything. And we were staying at my parents' place back in Columbus. And there's one day I'm outside doing something. I'm like cutting grass or something. I don't remember what I was doing. I come back inside and in the toy room, my parents, couple of grandkids running around. So they've got a sunroom / toy room. It's the toy room when the kids are staying over. And my son he's maybe 7 or 8 at the time. He's pieced 4 of these Axis and Allies maps together. And in the middle of it, he's got like a row of the hexes set up with all the treasure chests. And at one end, he's got a whole bunch of tanks and infantry. And at the other end, he's got a bunch of the Mage Knight dudes. And they're about to go at this Royal Rumble for the treasure chest in the middle.
Awesome.
And I asked him, I was like, so what's going on here? And he starts giving me the whole, it's not just, well, these guys have to do this and get here for this. It's that guy got mad at that guy in the last battle. And so he wants revenge at him. And I'm like, there wasn't really a last battle, but that's the story that I'm telling. Okay, sure, go for it. He had this whole backstory built around the battle that was about to happen. He'd never had another one before. There was no other battle to which he should have been referring, but he had crafted it all, this whole narrative of who wanted to get who, where, and why that guy wanted that specific treasure chest. I'm like, all right, what do you need me to do? Just roll some dice. Okay, I'm rolling dice. And he moved everything around, and all I had to do was sit there and chuck dice for him.
Awesome.
Oh, it was great. Yeah. It was a ton of fun. I got some pictures of it somewhere around the house. I say around the house, somewhere on a hard drive, right? I mean, who prints pictures anymore? But yeah, that's
beautiful.
It's, kind of like your nephew there. Wait, we can make a game out of this?
Yeah, that's beautiful. Love it. Love it.
So,
I'm going to have those stories when they're on the podcast in 40 years or whatever. They're going to be like, I'll tell you what it is. Here's what happened.
Yeah. We've had the kids on the podcast every once in a while to let the kids talk about some of their gaming experiences. We've pulled up the kids of Grog every once in a while and let them chat some. And it's fun because a lot of them are digital gamers. And so they'll be talking about doing something the same way in Destiny or playing, one of the Division games or something. It's just like us sitting around talking about some of the same games we've all played over the years, except theirs all involve a B button.
Right.
So. But.
Yeah, they're way better at it than I'm ever going to be.
Oh, yeah. So, hey, Chris, you had your kids in a bolt action game last year, right?
Yeah, so it was actually a couple of months ago. So my buddy, he does a bunch of the bolt action stuff, and they do it at a local game shop. They started doing, they did one kids event, and they're going to do another one in a couple of weeks. But I took my kids to the first one, and it was my son and daughter. They wound up playing against each other, which was a riot to watch. But they were both completely into it. And so then they wanted to do mini stuff. And so I have a ton of 28mm World War II stuff. And then I have a whole French village on the train. So I set up a little thing. It wasn't bolt action. It was a different rule set. And I set up for them to play it, and then my son, after like half an hour, wants to bail out and go play Fortnite. And then my daughter and I actually finished the game together. She's the one that wanted to, she was into it enough that she wanted to keep playing it. So that was fun to see, you know.
I thought I remembered pictures of you sharing from last year that the kids had ended up in a game together at the convention.
It was more recent. I have pictures of it, and it was great. You know, the guy who owns the shop, he posted some stuff on Facebook with all. It wasn't just my kids; there were a bunch of other kids that were involved and all that. That was the first time that the kids had really done any kind of mini stuff. I've been kind of lax on getting them into it, play video games and all that stuff. It was just funny to see the different ways. Like, they were both into it, but just sort of the different approaches they took to it. My son and, you know, had a very different approach than my daughter did to it. But anyway, I'm hoping, I mean, I'm going to take them. It's like another thing's going on in 2 weeks where I take them and hopefully they won't be playing just against each other. They'll be playing against other kids. So,
did they show any interest at all in the physical craftsmanship around the game? Any interest in building the terrain or painting the minis or anything, or just playing the game was enough for them?
They were mostly focused on playing the game. I could see my daughter is the more artistic of the two, so if there was going to be an interest in doing that, I think it would be more with her. My son is just too into the shiny, you know, aspects of it.
Yeah. And he's just blowing stuff up.
Yeah, he's totally a video game child. He wants to just fight and blow stuff up. He's actually very clever about it, but that's where his focus is at. My daughter's more into sort of the details aspects of it. And like I said, she's got an artistic bent, so potentially down the road I can see her, like, painting figures and things like that. But to be honest, the painting is not my strength, so.
Yeah.
I'm definitely much more of a player than I am a modeler or painter.
I remember somebody had posted something in the Wargamers group on Facebook, and the picture was this girl's fingers with some really intricately painted nails. It was like henna tattoo kind of detail. And we're like, what the hell? But you read the caption, and the guy's like, you know, I guess one advantage of having a dad who paints so many minis for his life is that you can do this level of detail work for your daughter. You know, the comment was something like, she never asked her mom to paint her nails for her anymore, or something like that. And of course, a bunch of the guys were giving him a hard time about it. But I mean, they were some really beautifully painted nails, and you're like, well, I guess transferable skill there. Anthony, any of the craftsmanship side of it for you, or you just wanted to like push minis around and blow stuff up?
No, I was painting minis right away, you know, not good at it immediately. And, by the late 80s, I started role playing 1977. And, definitely by the late 80s, I was painting Fiend, and then Warhammer and 40K came out. And that just lit a fire on me. And I started painting professionally in the late 80s and early 90s. I was painting professionally and, you know, winning small competitions. Nothing like the people nowadays blow me away. They're so good now. Not that they weren't good back then, but you know what I mean. And I was just thinking about that painting where you're like, if she wants to paint my miniatures, most of the like painted stuff that I have in my collection now is commissions that I did that were never picked up. You know,
yeah.
I never painted my own stuff because I was sitting there painting it. I'd be like, I could be making money right now. You know, yeah. So I'm actually looking at a mini right now. I'm gonna paint for a friend. I'm not even sure where it came from, but it's like a Baba. Oh, what's the name of that? The house with the
Baba Yaga.
Yes, it's a variant on that with like mechanical chicken legs and the weird little thing I'm gonna paint up.
Yeah, I painted a bunch back when I was still in high school back in the 80s, and probably hardly any since then. I have no idea how bad I would be at it today. I almost don't want to try. For me, one of the big attractions of the Mage Knight minis was that they came pre-painted. And so I've played Mage Knight once in my life, like by the actual rules. What I would do is I was getting the minis so dirt cheap at the convention when everybody was just trying to dump inventory. I'd shave them off and I'd go over to the guy selling the Warhammer minis and I'd go buy a giant bag of bases from him for $2, and there's like 40 bases in there. And I was sitting there re-gluing all the Mage Knight minis onto bases that you could actually use on a regular grid map instead of the giant oversized Mage Knight ones with the click wheels built into them.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did is that way I didn't have to paint stuff. It was a lot easier to just get out an X-Acto knife and cut them off of that base and glue them to something else than it was to go back and paint them all myself. And there was some dude that came by where I was sitting there kind of cutting and gluing between events one day. And he kind of looked at me. He's like, "Why are you gluing them to bases?" "Because they need a base, you know?" And he was saying, no, just go get pennies and glue them to pennies. And I kind of looked at him like he's completely off his rocker. And then I'm doing the math. I'm like, I just paid like $2 for 40 bases. It was like, you know, a nickel a base or something like that. Or I could be doing pennies and, you know, not even spent 40 cents on this. And I'm like, you know, that idea sounds really stupid at first. But economically, it makes perfect sense.
Totally. Totally. You know, I'm usually guessing right on things, but I guess completely wrong on Mage Knight. That first game map, my buddy, you probably know, I used to run KubliCon with him. He got some Mage Knight. He knew I was super into miniatures and so forth and painting, collecting and all that. And he showed me this Mage Knight. He's like, "Look at this. I bought a whole case. It's amazing. It's the best thing ever." I looked at him like, "No way. Miniatures players aren't going to want these. Like, they look like crap, these things. They're miniature players aren't going to want." I was kind of right. But I was just blocking out the fact that everyone else would want it.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Just like this thing. He painted miniatures and simple rules and get into this skirmish level. You don't need a lot of miniatures. Fantastic idea, but I'm just thinking from this, you know, I've got 5,000 points of orcs at home, and I'm like, I don't want that shit.
Yeah. Yeah, the paint jobs are pretty crap. I mean, they are very crude. They're sort of, you know, fifth grader with one eye closed, you know. They're not good paint jobs, but they're better than no paint job, which was kind of your option at the time.
Yeah. And the paint jobs have gotten much, much better now. The HeroClix, I mean, they're still not as good as...
Yeah. Well, and the D&D collectible minis that they sold in conjunction with 4th edition, there were some really good paint jobs on some of those.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, for being mass-produced out of some sweatshop in China, there's some artistic dudes working a sweatshop assembly line somewhere out there in China. Because there were some good-looking minis in there. And I think, you know, the combination of... Those were a little more expensive than being able to buy the inventory dumps of Mage Knight stuff, but you know, you could put together some decent collected games there. We actually, I finally sort of typed them all out, but there were a couple of us that kind of hashed together a basic, on the fly kind of set of minis rules just for the little skirmish battles, but the entire premise behind the rules was you had to look at your figure and you were assessing your stats off of your figure. So if they're wearing armor that covers this much of the figure, this was their armor class. And if they're wearing armor that covers more of the figure, this is, you know, if they've got a shield, they get this kind of bonus. And if they've got a big shield that's at least half of their height, then they get an additional bonus. And the weapons were statted out based on what the dude is holding on the figure. And that way you could go buy, you know, a handful of figures where they're selling like $5 for $6 or whatever. Go pick out a couple of minis, stat them out real quick based on what's on the figure itself and start playing.
Yeah.
And the idea was just get something on the table quick.
We should talk. Have I told you about the G.I. Joe game that I want to do?
No, but that sounds fascinating. Because I've... Well, there's a very specific reason why I'm saying that. I'm looking at a small moving box sitting in the office here with me full of G.I. Joe stuff that, you know, so my mom had carted around a ton of stuff over all of these years, all the toys that my brother and I grew up with because she knew eventually she'd end up with grandkids. Here's stuff for the grandkids to play with. The Legos, yeah. The grandkids took to the Legos right away. The grandkids did not take to the G.I. Joe stuff at all. And finally, about 4 years ago, my mom's like, "You got to take this home with you. I'm sick of having it take up space in my basement if your kids aren't going to play with it when they're over here." So now it's back at my house where the kids still don't play with it.
Right. Well, we could play with it.
I have no problem with that.
But same kind of thing, you know, what you've got is what you've got, and that determines your stats and your abilities and all that kind of stuff, and go from there.
Yeah. No, that sounds awesome. I'm totally down with statting out a G.I. Joe game. That would be fantastic.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah. Chris is trying to figure out how he can get out of that.
I just wish I had all my G.I. Joe stuff.
Right?
I got rid of it all.
When I was living in Germany in the mid-80s, you kind of got whatever the local exchange had. So there was always somebody, and this was before the internet where you could just look up every single G.I. Joe ever created anywhere. So somebody always showed up with, you know, some new kid moved into town and he always had one new dude that nobody else had ever seen. You're like, whoa, where the hell did that come from? And it's like something you ordered by mailing in proofs of purchase from a cereal box or something. But what we started doing with some of them where, you know, for birthday and Christmas presents, you'd eventually start getting some of the same ones over and over, is we would pop the screw out of the back of them and take them apart and start putting them back together in different configurations and repainting them and stuff. So we started creating a bunch of our own. So everybody really liked the ski trooper. I don't remember his name, Snow something or other, but because he was... Because he was a white uniform, you could paint that to anything you wanted pretty easily. That everybody wanted to buy a ton of those so we could use those to take apart and add to other things because you could paint them up pretty well.
Yeah.
So.
You remember the little plastic army men.
Army
we used to play with when we were kids. You reminded me, I met a new friend in elementary school. He played with the army men. Let's go over to his house. Okay, we went over there. And he had the Germans, which I hadn't seen. And he had tons of these, you know, gray and all their equipment and their trucks. And he had an airplane as well. And I was just like, oh, my God, what is this? There's Germans, too. I went crazy.
And nobody cared that they weren't painted.
I had to go. No, they were definitely not painted. I was still excited.
Yeah, we did that with the Airfix stuff. We used to have a ton of that. And at the time, we would just make up our own rule.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Sure.
You'd buy up all those figures, and you just, like, create your own. You'd have, like, a D6 and come up with your own. Like, oh, I hit, you know.
So what was your terrain, Chris?
What was the what?
Did you have anything you would use for terrain?
I don't know. We would mix and match stuff. I mean, I had play sets that we would, you know, you get some crappy plastic sandbag and then you dump your Airfix guys into that, spread it around. Yeah, we a lot of the stuff we did, we would do it outdoors in like a sandbox and just,
yeah,
you know, our own stuff.
See, we had a couple of army blankets that we had a couple of holes cut in here and there, not intentionally, like just holes that kind of happened over the years. And we'd put a couple of different stacks of books down on the floor, throw the green army blanket over top of it. So now you got a couple of hills,
yeah.
But where you had the holes cut in it, those kind of turned into bunkers that you could sort of tuck the figures into. And, right. And this is back when, Matchbox used to make a whole bunch of World War II, sets of minis, but also a couple of small 1/72 scale model kits. And so they had the half track, both the German American half track. They had a couple of tanks. They had some different trucks. But the way they manufactured them was almost as kind of a little mini diorama. So you'd have the half track and two or three dudes that would be the crew for the half track. But then you also had like a partial street and some bombed out building walls behind it. So if you got enough of these half tracks to put together, like, you know, an infantry platoon or a small company, you would end up with 6 or 8 different wall pieces as well that you could sort of piece together to look like a bombed out building in the middle of the battlefield somewhere. So we had a whole bunch of little matchbox terrain that we would throw out there to actually have some buildings on the map. And in the meantime, we've got bunkers and books underneath the blanket to make hills and totally making up the rules
exactly
as you went.
The same sort of stuff we would do. You take those, you get those little sets or whatever, and you take those pieces and And, you know, it didn't really matter whether it was Matchbox or something else. You just kind of mix them. I mean, when you're 12, you don't really care. You mix and match anything together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, honestly, I don't know. I mean, to be fair, I see people doing that, you know, at 35 or 40. You know, I'm 40. I see it on tape all the time now, so.
It's a far cry from showing up at the game conventions and seeing the, you know, the walls of Troy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, the whole thing is, like, you go to any convention and you see some mind-blowingly good stuff, and you see some stuff, like, really, are you putting that down on the table, you know? You see both ends of the spectrum, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I lived in California in the 90s, I went to a couple of pretty small conventions around the Bay Area. I don't ever recall Kublai Khan being one of them, but some of the smaller ones here and there that were mostly role playing stuff.
I'm betrayed.
Yeah. Sorry, but at the time, I was chasing around different collectible card game stuff, because this would have been 94, 95, 96, somewhere in there.
Kublai Khan was called Manifest at that time.
Then it's possible I made it to one of them. But while having been in a couple of those conventions, at the time there was nothing overly visually impressive in any of them when you're kind of walking around in there, not compared to the first Origins I ever went to in 05 when minis were still a pretty big thing at the show and you had this giant room of museum quality diorama tables set up just waiting for the battles to happen. And you had the walls of Troy, and it was probably 60 or 65 feet wide. It was only about 15 feet deep because the whole point was the assault on the walls. But I grew up going to military museums all over the place. And so it was like walking into a museum and going, holy crap. Somebody had a really large, elaborate Battle of Hoth set up. And quite frankly, I had no idea how they reached anything in the middle of that table because the table was so huge. They had to be using those extendo grabber things that, you know, old folks get to get the jars off the top shelf. There's no other way they could have been moving stuff around the middle of that table. Couple of ridiculously complicated World War I trench complexes for some big trench warfare.
And Battle of Hoth was Michael Webb from Alliance.
Is that who that was? Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
You know the one I'm talking about. I mean, it was.
I do know the one you're talking about.
It was like a helipad sized table. I mean, it was enormous. And unfortunately, I never got to actually see it played. But I'm standing at the table thinking, how the hell do you reach the middle of this table? I mean, it's just like you just have some small children and you hold them over the table so that they can reach the middle for you. You know, that was all I could think of. But yeah, I mean,
that's
why
you have small children, so they can work the farm and reach things in the middle of the table.
There you go.
Those are the only two reasons.
But
having the ball boys at the ball games.
Yeah, there you go.
At Wimbledon or at the U.S. Open.
It was just astounding how snazzed out these things were. Compared to anything I'd ever seen at any of the smaller conventions over the years. I was just stunned at how gorgeous they were.
Part of the hobby, because, and this is something that I'm always on the fence on, there's a real division between like the artistry and the playability, because I've played in plenty of games where the stuff is just mind-blowingly gorgeous, but the game is no fun at all. But on the other side, you play in a game, and the game may be fun, but the table's so atrocious that you kind of can't get past, like, okay, this is a great game, but it's so ugly. Like, it's,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of finding that balance in between. Like, it looks good. It's not like museum level quality diorama, but it looks good and it's still a fun game to play, you know.
Yeah.
It's just interesting because it's a great hobby. I'm all for it, but there are some people who are definitely into it for like the painting and the modeling. And I'm on the other. I just want to play a game and have fun, you know. And I appreciate the skill that people bring to these things. Like, a good-looking table is, like, great. But at the same time, I just want to play a game and have fun, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, and we have the research to back this up. Anthony was actually a part of us getting the research to back this up. There is a non-trivial component of the hobby for whom their primary motivation is the crafting of parts of the hobby. It's the actual physical craftsmanship of it that is such a big deal to them.
Yeah, I experienced that personally in my local group. I mean, there are guys that's what they do. I mean, they are totally dedicated to building terrain and painting the miniatures. And they're not really, I mean, there are guys in my local group who really aren't interested in playing a game. Like, they want to do the cool stuff and see it on the table. And they're happy that if you're playing the game, they're happy to see that. But they're not really interested in the game so much as the craftsmanship and the art.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not knocking it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just there's people come to the hobby from different perspectives. Is all I'm saying.
All right, absolutely. Oh, totally. Hey, yeah. Anthony, you were asking about the sort of colonial era trappers and Indians thing from Historicon. Per our good buddy Cyrano, he said he's pretty sure it was probably something from Muskets and Tomahawks.
Yeah.
I just threw that in the chat there for you. If you pop that link open, that might be what you're looking for. So. We're getting pretty close to our 1 hour mark here, which is kind of where we box in these podcasts. And so, look, there was no agenda, no special topic tonight. It was just a couple of guys talking about games. And, you know, I imagine the whole point here was to capture the same kind of conversation we'd have sitting around a bar table somewhere after hours at a convention, having a chat about games. And, I like to think we probably got close to that tonight. So mission accomplished. Anthony,
it's great talking to you guys.
Anthony, quick question. What's the very next game to hit your table?
That's a great question. You know, I still judge the Kublacon Game Design Contest. I'm still the chair of the judging committee. And so we've got several games submitted. The submission deadline is this Friday. And so we'll get several more by then. And then, quite literally, it's going to be those games for a month. I'm going to play a lot of, and they're all amateur designers. Some of them are amazing, and some of them are, like, not. but it's always great to see what people are doing and, you know, give them some guidance and some help and some stuff along the way. And then to see the you know, the great stuff. It's just like, wow. I'm just so glad that you put this on paper and that we're playing it, and let's get it shorn up and send you off to get it published, you know?
That's always fun to see when you help a new guy break into the industry, a new guy, new gal, new person break into the industry. Chris, I know what the next thing to show up in the mailbox is going to be. What's the next thing actually going to hit the table?
It may very well be the Dark Valley. I'm already talking to my buddy who has it, and that – we try to get together and pick up a game that we can do for a weekend, and that's probably going to be it. I don't know if it's going to happen before Azad. There's a lot to do. Like I said, there's playtesting and all that. But, my next game is going to be the Dark Valley.
I guess the better question would have been, do you have enough table space cleared that you can actually put a game on there, or is it all still unopened boxes piling up on the table?
Well, I added a new table to my stacks. if I had to, I could get a game onto a table. I'd have to shift some stuff around. yeah, I know, it's hilarious.
you know, there are times when I have to go back and edit out some of the laughter from some of these things so that the audience doesn't get stuck for, like, 12 solid seconds of us laughing at something. I'm going to have to leave the laughter in on this because it's too appropriate.
No, that's pretty good, I have to admit.
You know, you could buy a set of shelves to put the games on, too, and actually use the table for playing them.
Yeah, you know, there's an amazing organizational plan that I have to work on.
That's crazy talk. What do you mean?
I literally on my kitchen table right now next to my computer, I have 9 games sitting right in front of me immediately. Then I have another side table with like another 12 games on
that. Jeez.
And that's just my kitchen.
Yeah, on that note, I think we're going to call it a night because I don't know where we go from there. Anthony, thank you for joining us, especially on kind of short notice. I really appreciate it. And we're going to make it a point to dial you back in after Kublai Khan and let you tell us about some of those designs for the contest.
Yeah, cool. You bet.
And Chris, go try and find a table to have some dessert on.
All right. That's good, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right. And audience, thank you very much for tuning in with us here on Mentioned in Dispatches. We appreciate you joining us also, and we will catch you on the next show.